This is Dean Cullen from Ireland, and Gangland Wire is the best true crime podcast. We just love the mob stories over here.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire. Creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Welcome all you wiretappers out there. The classic old Ice House building in Midtown, Kansas City. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, this is going to be the second episode of a multi-part episode about the lifetimes and career of Harry the Hook Alleman, Chicago outfit enforcer. We may make this a series of shows. We have a whole month of Chicago outfit stories. People in Chicago seem to like that, don't you, Ben Ellickson and Rich Sullivan and a bunch of you guys up there like to have a whole month of outfit stories. And we have...
We're flying our Chicago flag.
And we're flying our Chicago flag, Ben. And we also have our bottle from the Standard Brewing Company that Ben dug up and so generously sent down to us to help decorate our studio. I think he's angling to bribe us to get more Chicago outfit stories, Aaron.
Well, here's one for him.
Well, here's one. Here's going to be several for you, Ben. We got Mike Byrne on the line right here. Welcome, Mike.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
So Mike is our resident Chicago outfit expert. Mike runs a Facebook page called the Chicago Outfit Old and Current News Articles. You'll see Red Womet, a former outfit associate and FBI undercover agent, commenting a lot on that. He helps out a lot on that and adds his commentary, you know, kind of like that. Talk about the information from the man, mouths of the man who did it and who witnessed it, and we're right there. So it's a great Facebook page. I recommend everybody go out and follow that page. Mike, you guys do a really good job getting those news articles out about the Chicago outfit.
Well, thanks. Thank you very much, Gary.
Well, tonight we've done Harry Alleman's early life, his marriage, his childhood, where he first got into the mob. He was in the, what was it, Mike, the Grand Avenue crew? Or no, Taylor Street crew, right?
Taylor Street crew, yeah. He was a Taylor Street guy. He's under Joe Ferriola.
And one of his early jobs, Joe Ferriola sent him and particularly his running buddy, Butch Petroselli, out to line up all the bookmakers. Joe wanted to organize the bookmakers in 1970s Chicago like the 1930s and 1920s bootlegging outlets, the speakeasies and other people that sold illegal booze, wanted to get them all lined up so he could charge a street tax. He needed to know who they all were and how much action they had going, then they could figure out how much tax they needed to charge him. He was an entrepreneurial mob boss.
Oh, correct. Yeah. Oh, yeah. He was a tremendous earner for the outfit.
One of the things that I remember when we were talking in the last episode and had looked through the notes and read things before that we kind of maybe forgot to mention, I didn't realize this about Harry Alleman, was that he went to the Chicago Art Institute and graduated.
Correct. He don't know if he wanted to pursue a career in the arts, but yeah, according to his stepdaughter and stuff. Yeah, he went. Yeah, went to one of the guys, a rarity actually back then for a guy, you know, an outfit guy like that, go to college and graduate and everything and stuff. And then ironically, later on in life, when he was in prison, he did paintings, and actually some of his paintings are hanging in bars along Taylor Street still to this day.
They're probably worth a lot when you consider who did the artwork. Yeah. Here in the notes, it was the Chicago Academy of Fine Arts, and he graduated in 1958 with a commercial arts diploma. something he put to use while he was in prison, I guess.
Yeah, that was good for the the downtime you had in the penitentiary, wasn't it? I knew another guy that professional burglar here in Kansas City that went up to Leavenworth, and he spent his time painting the whole time.
I guess, yeah. I mean, you have all that free time in your hands. You got to do something to pass the time.
You know, as I researched this guy, he was a guy, they said he was a small guy. He wasn't a big man at all. He was not right. Physically imposing, but as we talked about, he had eyes that said, "I'll kill you."
Yeah, that 1,000-yard stare, that cold, like, kind of dead-eye look on his face. Yeah, I mean, you see any of his mug shots or photos or any videos of him leaving court. I mean, yeah, he wasn't a big guy by size or like, you know, but yeah, I mean, but he just had that look about him, though, that, you know, just kind of seems like, you know, yeah, if you're that kind of guy you'd want to see in your rearview mirror at nighttime following you.
Really? They also said that he could go in a split second from kind of easygoing, intelligent, hail fellow, well-met sort of a guy to all of a sudden being menacing and threatening with absolutely no remorse. And he could do that in just a second. As you can just see him talking to some of these bookmakers that are, you know, saying, well, you know, we really don't think we need to pay that street tax. You can just see him starting out, you know, being nice and chatty and then just going to that cold-eyed dude. Can't you just see that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely. I remember reading some old articles of guys who paid street tax to him saying that when they would meet with Harry eventually, usually he would bring someone with him and the other guy would do the talking while Harry would just sit and stare. And that was usually enough to scare the guy to giving up whatever they asked for, basically. I mean, just the look on his face was enough, I think, to scare these bookmakers into turning over. I mean, obviously they had to make an example out of a few of these guys, but, you know, and I think that's why. I mean, they would kill some independent bookmakers, and then the next time, you know, they dealt with a guy who was kind of on the fence about paying the street tax, they would just make a look what happened to this guy, and they'd be more than happy to hand over the money.
Yeah, really. All those gray area businesses were susceptible to the outfit's extortion. Red knows a lot about that. They extorted money from him all the time. You know, one of the earliest...
Oh, yeah, definitely.
One of the earliest murders that he was suspected of was a guy named Sam Cesario, called him Sambo. And he had once actually been an uncle of Harry's by marriage and was divorced from his mom's sister. So you remember anything about it? It's kind of interesting. The guy who wanted Sambo hit was in the joint, Milwaukee Phil, Felix Aldericio, and he actually died before the guy got hit. Can you remember anything about that one?
They refer to that as the hit. What was it called? The hit beyond the grave or something. They were always referred to that one because, yeah, according Sam, you know, Sambo, I guess, he got married to the Phil Aldericio's girlfriend, and I guess, which was a big no-no. I mean, I don't know if it was like that in other cities, like Kansas City mob, but the one thing those guys did tolerate was messing around with someone's girlfriend or wife. You know, it was just, you know, that was a big no-no, and I guess, you know, once Phil went to jail, went to prison, Sam and Phil's girlfriend started dating and stuff. And once Phil got wind of it in prison, one of his last requests before he passed away was he wanted Sambo killed. And according to investigators, they pinned it on Harry and Butch Petroselli were the two shooters, they claim, who did it. And the murder happened at was just off Taylor Street, which is rare because, like we spoke about it in the previous podcast, they don't shit in their own neighborhoods, those guys. So killing someone in a mob neighborhood was kind of like, you know, you want to bring too much deal. You know, I mean, obviously the police are going to be there, the feds are going to be there. So to have that murder done there was big statement, I think.
Yeah, that was a huge statement.
And they did it right, and they did it in front of and they did it right in front of his wife, Phil's ex-girlfriend. So she was a witness to the murder. It's like that. So I guess Harry, according to the police, Harry and Butch were wearing ski masks and showed up, and they pulled out their guns and blasted Sambo right in the front lawn.
Yeah, that's what I'd read. They were sitting out on lawn chairs out in front of their house. And you know, Aaron, you'll be happy to know that this was a brownstone right off of Taylor Street, 1071 West Polk, and it's still there. I looked it up.
You looked that one up?
I looked that one up.
Every time we do an episode.
Yeah, I passed by there a few years ago, actually. There's a really good restaurant like two blocks away. So I was over there, and I was like, you know, and I knew the address just from reading about the story so many times. But yeah, it's still there. The house, I mean, I don't know who lives there now, but it still looks, I mean, I saw an old photo of it in the time of when the murder took place, and it looks very similar still. Not much has changed. That area is still very... that never got gentrified too much, that little pocket of that neighborhood there. Even though that area is getting gentrified, that little pocket seems like it's kind of, you know, it's kind of the time that land, you know, the, you know, it's time for, kind of forgot that land existed right there.
I'm guessing that restaurant down the street's not a Sambo's.
No, it's not a Sambo's.
No, not at all, no. that'd be ironic if it was.
Wouldn't it be?
It's a little Italian place that's kind of well-known, but yeah, it's kind of, you know, that neighborhood is very, you know, like the Grand Onagon area, very Italian. So, yeah, it's, you know, you're not going to find too many other kind of restaurants there like that.
If you want to eat out at Grand and Ogden, what do you want? You want deli or you want pizza, huh? Or you want lasagna?
Oh, that's a tough call right there. That's, you know, that's, I guess whatever, you know, it's, you know, it's that's the hardest part about living in one of those neighborhoods is, you know, is overeating. There's too much good food, you know?
You know, I read one thing that this Louis Alamedia told a story about Harry Elliman when he eventually will come in and be a government source on Harry. And he claims that it was in 1972, they were sitting around the Survivors Club and they were reading an article about Crazy Joe Gallo getting killed while he was eating at Umberto's Clam House. Do you remember that? Did you ever hear that story?
Yep.
They said
how Harry was like, Harry was very wound up and excited about how it was a public hit. They did it in such a public place. And I guess, according to Louis, Harry wouldn't shut up about it. He kept on talking about it and how, like, it was a beautiful hit, he would say. It was beautiful. It was done right out in the open and stuff. And, like, and I guess, according to Louis, like, you know, kind of, you know, it seemed like that Harry was kind of inspired almost by that hit. Like, he almost wanted to do something similar almost, you know, but yeah, I guess he was very, very intrigued by it, very inspired by it.
Maybe he already did back October 19th of 1971 with one of those two-man shooter teams.
Yep.
He did. We only had a couple
exactly,
like
yeah.
that.
I mean, I think, oh, really? Oh, about you guys? Yeah, here in Chicago, yeah, I mean, mostly, even Chicago, I mean, there was some, you know, quite a few public ones done. Most in the 70s, it was kind of a big thing in Chicago. There was a lot of public executions, but for the most part, those, you know, with the, you know, pinning the guy in the trunk and pinning him in the airport parking lot was the most popular method of getting rid of somebody. But yeah, there was occasionally, I think they did to make a statement. I think guys like Harry was actually linked to several public hits, and he was never convicted on any of them, but he was linked to several of them. I think that was Harry. I think Harry kind of liked that. He liked that. I think he got off of that adrenaline rush. I mean, which I imagine has got to be quite a rush. You know, you're, first of all, you're killing somebody, but then, you know, doing it right out in the open with straight, you know, witnesses looking at you and stuff. Even if you're weird, most of the time they wore ski masks and stuff, but I mean, still, I mean, any, I mean, you know, like, I'm sure Kansas City's similar. I mean, every city traffic and there's cops everywhere, to, you know, to be able to just do it like that so brazenly, kill somebody in a restaurant or out in their front lawn and just walk away and, you know, never get arrested or convicted for it. So, I mean, it's a pretty amazing thing when you think about it.
In a restaurant or a bar, you don't know whether you're going to have a bartender that has a gun back there and wants to be a hero, or maybe off-duty cop in there that's carrying and wants to be a hero. Yeah. You just, you know, it's an out-of-control situation for a few minutes.
Yeah, I mean, that's what makes it so intriguing to these guys. It's like the fact that they have these guys have, you know, nerves of steel to be able to just go into a place like that and march in like they own it and, you know, and do whatever they need to do. And then a lot of times witnesses say they wouldn't even run out. They would just kind of, you know, slowly kind of stroll out of the restaurant, get back into whatever work car they had, and, you know, they would leave the neighborhood. You know, it's amazing, you know, what those guys could get away with back then.
The mob provided them a work car?
Yes, they had a work car. They caught, we had a whole show on the work car. You know, I'm going to digress a little bit, folks. You know the story about the work car that they caught those two guys with up in Chicago. I can't remember who it was now. You may know. But they had these hidden compartments for guns. Well, in 19...
Oh, yeah.
You remember that?
That was Phil Alderisio and Chuck DiNicoletti.
Right, yes, right.
So they were both caught in the work car. Yep, that was like, I think, in the 50s, I think, maybe late 50s they were caught. Yeah, they were staking out somebody.
Yeah.
And a cop car rolled up on them, and they didn't have much to take them in on, so they just kind of, the cops kind of, you know, got them for mopery, you know, just a base charge. They took them in because, you know, they didn't belong in the neighborhood, basically. They thought it was 2 in the morning, and they're like, what are you doing here? And they're like, oh, we're waiting for a friend at a bar. I think they told the police or something, and the police didn't buy it. And then once they had the car taken down to the station, they got a look at the car, and, yeah, they found compartments. They found, they would soup these cars up. These cars could go faster than any cop car could go. I mean, they had, you know, it was like, you know, even back then, they had, like, the switches, the headlights would go out if they hit a switch, or they had the brake lights would go out so they couldn't get, no one could see the license plates, and they were taking off and stuff. It's pretty amazing what those guys would do to these cars, and they would use them just once. Usually they would use them on a job and do the murder, and then usually either drop the car off somewhere or they'd store it in a garage somewhere for a couple months, like a friend's garage or an associate's garage, and let it sit for a while, and then maybe, you know, change the license plates and do a couple modifications. And I think a couple times they've used work cars on several jobs, but for the most part, a lot of these guys like to use them just once and then dump the car somewhere.
Yeah, we had one situation in the earlier 50s, a 1949 or a 50, must have been 50, it was a 50 Ford. They bought it brand new and licensed it to a false name with an address at a union hall in Kansas City, and it had several hidden compartments. They did a hit with it. They got away, and then they just dumped it and left it on the street, and they ended up towing it. So it's a pretty common thing in most of these, probably all the big cities that have an outfit that are anywhere organized at all, probably all do some things like that, which kind of brings me to Harry, and when he got his own crew, he gets his own crew going, which is what I said before, but he then has guys he sends out. He sets up the burglaries and plots a strategy and puts together teams and fences the merchandise, and he did the same thing Joe Ferriola did. He would give each crew member $500. He had police radios and guns and disguises and a whole bunch of stolen cars stashed for different jobs. That's where he got this Louis Alamedia was working with him, doing jobs.
By the early 70s, Harry was running his own crew, and yeah, he had his own crew of burglars and thieves who would, you know, yeah, he would send them out on jobs, and, you know, they would, you know, do everything from, at one point they broke into the owner of the Chicago Stadium's home, or the person who owned the concessions of the stadium.
Yeah.
So they got a tip that there was a lot of money in the house and stuff. So, I mean, they did their homework, these guys. I mean, when they would go do a robbery or a burglary, I mean, they would, you know, I mean, a lot of times, they, you know, there wouldn't be as much money as they planned on or something like that, but these guys, they would go to great lengths, you know. They wouldn't just, you know, just drive by a house and just break in. I mean, they used tipsters. I mean, a lot of times they even had cops on the payroll. Cops would give these guys tips on, you know, on people, even the cops would receive a small cut of the percentage of it, you know, and stuff. So these guys, being there, they hustled. These guys, you know, they probably worked more than the average 9-to-5 guy, you know, at the time.
Yeah, really. Oh, that guy that when they couldn't find the money, and the guy that owned the Chicago concessions, actually it was one of his employees that he was supposed to take the money home after the game and then go bring it back in bank the next day, and they couldn't find the money. Harry was very disappointed. What I read, they found $1,800, took it back to Harry. What was interesting, and the police learned that at this particular robbery, he told them always use shoelaces to tie up people because they work really well. They're not noticeable. Like you take in rope or, you know, handcuffs, or you get caught with anything like that. People, the cops will think something about it, but you just got some extra shoelaces laying around. You're not going to think much about it. So he tied the lady up with shoelaces and left her there. And he was really disappointed, but he ended up giving her $500 anyway. I think he maybe, I see the breakdown now. He got $1,800 and he gave each guy $500 each, which there was two guys. So Henley made $800 out of that. But their next score, they made up for it. They got $25,000 in jewelry, and he only gave each of them $500.
Exactly. Yeah, I believe on one of the robberies, it was an older couple. Like they robbed, and they tied them up, and then I don't know if it was Harry's idea or one of the guys in the crew, but after a certain amount of time, they would call the police with a payphone and tip them off and say, "Hey, people are tied up in the house, so go get them," because I guess they felt bad they were an older couple and stuff. So I mean I'm not trying to say these guys had a conscience or anything though, but I think they actually felt bad though that they had to tie up this older couple and stuff, so they actually tipped the police off on their own burglary to let them know that, hey, listen, go to this house and make sure these people are okay.
But yeah,
which is kind of ironic, considering they just robbed them. But
and one of those newspaper articles you put up, there was a list that the newspaper had of all the murders that he was suspected of, and I typed them out here just so I could kind of keep it in my mind. I'm not going to read off every one of them, and we'll talk about a few of them, but there's like, I think, 20 or 21 murders that they printed in the paper that he was suspected of doing. He was a prodigious killer.
Oh, definitely, yeah, there's a long list. I mean, I'm sure he probably had a hand in some of those, but I mean, most of the time, like a lot of these outfit killers, they try to pin as many murders on them as possible, but I don't doubt that he had a hand in a lot of these ones, though. It wouldn't surprise me.
Do you remember anything about this guy named Frank Rizza, who was a bookie and did some cocaine dealing? He was a former Chicago cop.
Yeah, he was a Chicago cop who worked like the traffic, traffic patrol, and he was doing like a little bookmaking, not much bookmaking, and he was using cocaine. And I think he was even selling a little bit of cocaine, and he got busted, I think, and that's how Harry got wind of him. And he and Harry approached him shortly after his arrest, and he demanded a lot of money. I can't remember the figure off the top of my head, but it was like, I want to say it was like $25,000-$30,000 he wanted for back pay, for doing bookmaking without permission. And then he wanted like $1,000 a month. But Rizza was a distant relative of Angelo LaPietra, who's the boss of the 26th Street crew, Chinatown crew. And Rizza went and saw LaPietra and asked him if he could intervene and help out, which LaPietra did, and he actually had. So all Rizza had to do was just pay, I think, a monthly. Instead of paying like the $30,000 back penalty, he just had to basically just pay a street tax every month and stuff like that. So that kind of saved him. But then I think part of the deal was Harry wanted Rizza to, point out other bookmakers to him, so Harry could, grab him and stuff and make him a street, make him a partner in his street taxes and stuff. So, I mean, Rizza, he sounds like a real piece of work. I mean, I think he was a dirty cop who was just basically, he just got caught up in it and stuff, though. But he wasn't really involved with the crew, but he was kind of like, I think Harry for some reason trusted him. Because I know he testified later in some hearings, in the sentencing hearings for Harry Allen and stuff. So he knew enough about Harry, I think, he was around pretty often, I believe.
Yeah, he ended up setting up this other bookmaker, this name Anthony Reitinger.
Correct.
Do you remember that story? That's kind of an interesting story.
I think that was one of the guys that I think Harry asked Rizza about him, and Rizza knew him. Rizza knew Anthony Reitinger, and Harry asked Rizza to step in and say, "Hey, can you bring him in and tell him all we want to do is talk? We don't want to hurt him. We just want him to pay his street tax." And I guess Anthony Reitinger basically told Rizza, like, "Fuck Harry. I'm not paying those guys anything." Rizza came back to Harry and passed the message along. Harry goes, "Well, we're gonna have to do something about this." And even Rizza knew what that meant, and he even said, give me another chance. I can bring them in. And still, after a second chance, after Rizzo told me, like, listen, these guys are serious. These guys are going to, and Anthony just wanted nothing to do with it. And then on, I believe it was Halloween night, 1975, is when Anthony Rettinger, he was in a pizza place on Fullerton Avenue. I think it was Mama Luna's pizza place, dining, and when two men with ski masks or hockey masks or ski masks came in with shotguns, and they shot, blasted his top of his head off and stuff. And that was another, you know, obviously a very public execution, which was what Harry was supposed to be known for. But that one, another one that here, it was supposed to be Harry Allen and Butch Petroselli were supposed to, they're the two suspected trigger men in the Anthony Rettinger murders. And I've seen the crime scene photos in that one, and that's one of the more brutal crime scene photos I've seen of an outfit head. I mean, the top of his head is basically just torn off with a shotgun blast.
So he got to do his Joey Gallo head. He walked into a restaurant
exactly.
full of people and blasted a guy and walked out.
He got to do another one.
Another one, yeah.
And the weird thing is Anthony Rettinger's daughter later told police that the night of his murder, her father told her, if anything ever happens to me, go to your grandmother's house. So obviously Anthony knew I think he knew his days were numbered, I believe, which makes it, that's the part that just makes no sense, is the fact that these guys know they're in trouble, they know their mom's going to kill them, and they still won't pay the money. I mean, maybe some guys just don't want to feel like they're getting extorted, but if it's a life and death situation, I mean, what's $1,000 to a bookmaker who's probably making $5,000-$6,000 a month?
Yeah.
I think some of these guys just think it's not going to happen to them. That maybe they'll get a pass or something. But yeah, that was a pretty brutal murder.
But Rettinger didn't have any. He wasn't connected to anybody like Rizzo was.
He was known around Chicago. He was a known bookmaker, but he wasn't tied to any outfit guys or anything. So, I mean, the only chance he had to save him was Vince Rizzo, who was the only guy who could have really, and Rizzo tried to help him, tried to talk some sense into him, and after that happened, I think Harry finally got his chance to do his Joe Gallo hit. He got it.
Maybe he should have gone to Anthony the Hook LaPietra to resolve the issue like Rizzo did.
Well, he would have had to pay the Hook a whole shitload of money. He was not connected at all, I don't think. Best I could tell, he wasn't connected at all.
Yeah.
Well, here, interesting, in Gary's notes, the restaurant was the Mama Luna at 5109 right. West Fullerton Avenue in Chicago, Illinois, 60639.
I think it's still there, that building's still there, I'm sure.
Still
of that.
There, yeah. The restaurant's still there, too.
It's still Mama Luna's?
Restaurant, actually.
Oh, cool.
At least the last time I checked, it was still open. Yeah, it's still the same location, too.
Man, we ought to have you have that Mob Tour app, all the places you can go and eat in Chicago
really?
Where a hit went down. Bring your lawn chairs. You can sit right out front of the house.
Have a picnic on the lawn.
That's right. Neighborhood's so gentrified now that they'll go ahead and they'll just...
I don't think I'd want to dine in there.
Yeah. You'll go ahead and get rifle-butted now for free. No, I don't know how bad that neighborhood is.
You know, we're digressing a little bit. Here's another little digression is Frank Rizzo had a daughter named Pia Rizzo, and she was on Chicago Mob Wives. I guess there was a show of the Chicago Mob
Correct.
Wives like there was back in New York. So do you remember that show? I don't remember it at all.
I remember when the show was on, but I didn't get a chance to really watch it. But I remember in Chicago when they were filming in Chicago.
Yeah,
they got a lot of bad press because I remember that a lot of the Italian neighborhoods wanted nothing to do with it. They wouldn't even if they tried going to like a restaurant in those neighborhoods, they wouldn't even allow them to come in and film even in the restaurants. I mean, there was a big backlash with that Mob Wife show.
Well, here's another one: Nora Suisse, Frank the German's daughter, was on that, and she got in a big to do with Pia Rizzo saying. She told him that her dad was a dirty Chicago cop who worked for the mob and then ratted everybody out.
As opposed
to... those children, it's funny to see those things. I mean, it's like, I mean, I don't know, those reality shows, it gets a little too... I mean, once they start doing mob, and the funny thing is not a single woman on that show was even a mob wife. So it's like the title of the show wasn't even like, it was all daughters and stepdaughters of mobsters. It was, you know, so, I mean, it just shows you how hard it was. I mean, they really had to scrape the bottom of the barrel to get some of those. I mean, that's the best they could do to get in that show. I mean, I guess Nora Schweitz was the only really one whose father was a really well-known mobster on that show. I mean, all the other ones, they were, like most of the guys in that show, their fathers, they weren't even like real mobsters. They were like associates or like guys like RZA, was a corrupt cop who, he knew mobsters and stuff. So I think they had a better time in New York getting the people in New York to be more cooperative with that Chicago. Chicago just seemed like they had a hard time. I know they tried getting the daughter of Michael Spilotro on the show, but she turned him down.
Close us down and do a third episode. Can you come back for a third episode, Mike?
Oh, sure, yeah.
All right. If you have a friend or relative who has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I got to say, folks, you need to get the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available for rent or purchase on Amazon. You want to stream that, watch it, own it, because there's some really great details. And you're going to learn more, not only from the movie Gangland Wire, but when you download Gary's app, the Kansas City Mob Tour. For $1.99, you can take your own personalized turn-by-turn tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. And then, if that's not enough that you need to learn more, Gary's got his book, Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos. All right. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Mike.
Goodnight, guys.
Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.
Wednesday evening, because I was thinking on the way over to tell Aaron
whatever works best for you guys.
And next time we'll talk, we'll really get into the Billy Logan hit. Was it Billy Logan? The Logan hit,
yeah, Billy Logan
and
the
Robert Cooley, the whole Double Jeopardy and all that. So we'll probably do two more episodes on that. That's a pretty long story. So we'll end up with a whole month of Chicago.
Oh, sure. Oh, definitely. We can definitely get, two
okay.
out of those.
All right. All right, Mike. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Good, good talking to you guys.
Yeah, you too.
Right.
Talk to you later.
Give me a call or shoot me a message on Facebook and let me know when you guys want to do it.
Okay. All right.
All right.
Bye.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks.
Talk to you later.
What do you want to do now?
Oh, that's probably good. Let's go home.